Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. And welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Shane Bernard, whose book, The Teche, A History of Louisiana's Most Famous Bayou, is being honored as one of the Humanities Books of the Year by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. We'll also hear from James Nolan, whose new book is Flight Risk, Memoirs of a New Orleans Bad Boy, and Kathleen Schrenk, author of A Dog Steals Home. Shane Bernard has what seems like a dream job. He's the historian and curator to the McElhenney Company and Avery Island, Inc. Shane is the author of several Louisiana classics, Swamp Pop, Creole and Cajun Rhythm and Blues, Tabasco, An Illustrated History, and The Cajuns, Americanization of a People. He lives in New Iberia, mere three blocks from the subject of his latest book, Teche, A History of Louisiana's Most Famous Bayou. Shane Bernard, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Now, in Louisiana, it always seems like we live so closely to beauty and history that sometimes we take them for granted and need to be reminded to take a closer look. And you're certainly doing that in this book.
Yes, I grew up in Lafayette, and I really did not, as a child, have a good understanding of the history that was all around me. You really have to look for it sometimes. You know, for example, you know, I grew up along the Vermilion River in Lafayette. As a kid, we often played along it, but I didn't really have a good idea of, you know, the Civil War actions that took place along that bayou. And it really wasn't until fairly recently that I realized that the Vermilion at one time was one sugar plantation after another. And, you know, I went to Plantation Elementary as a kid. It never occurred to me until I was an adult. Actually, it was just a few years ago that I realized it was called Plantation Elementary because it's set on an old plantation. And so history is often there if you look for it. And in the case of the Teche, you know, I moved to New Iberia in 1997 to be closer to Avery Island. And it was only after I had crossed the Teche on my way to work and home, who knows how many times, before I began thinking, you know, I wonder if I could write a history of this waterway, if there's enough source material out there to do that.
Well, you go all the way back to the beginning and you talk about what a rich Indian heritage the area has and how the Teche is an area of great natural resources for Louisiana.
Yes, you know, on Avery Island where I work, there's a 4,500-year-old Indian mound. At least it's been radiocarbon dated tentatively as that old. In Lauraville, right up the bayou from New Iberia, there are two Indian mounds right in the middle of town. And, you know, it's not unheard of for someone to find an arrowhead or a spear tip on the ground somewhere around here purely by chance. I know my five-year-old nephew found an arrowhead in City Park in New Iberia. I was very jealous of him for doing that. But I bought it for him for $5, and now it sits on my counter at home. So there was a lot of Native American activity along the Teche, and I was fortunate enough when I canoed the Teche, and the second part of my book is a canoe journal. The first part is a straightforward narrative history of the Teche, but in the second part, it's a canoeing journal of my trip down the Teche. I was fortunate enough to have two archaeology graduates canoeing with me, one of whom had excavated an Indian mound along the bayou through the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. And so they were able to point out to me, you know, there's an Indian mound, there's a midden, there's another Indian mound. I might not have known that if it wasn't for them because, you know, you see a bunch of shells spilling out of the banks into the bayou. That's all it seems to most people, but actually it takes an expert to tell you, well, that's a mound complex from several hundred years ago, if not 1,500 years ago. And so the history is often hiding there in plain sight, as I previously mentioned.
You are very smart to do that as part of this book, because I think that is the first question everybody would ask. Well, how much time have you spent on this bayou, you know? And it was venturesome and fun to read that part of the book.
Yeah, we would see all sorts of things going up and down the bayou.
One of the things that I found so interesting is the war years. You really bring to life what a difficult landscape this was to wage war in. It's as if the battlefield itself were hostile to humans. You know what I mean?
Yes. I wasn't the first person to write about the Civil War along the Têche in detail, but I sort of synthesized those earlier works and compressed them and got down to the real core issues. And even a lot of people around here who know that the Têche was invaded during the Civil War didn't know that it was invaded three separate times. Every time by U.S. General Nathaniel Banks, who was a political appointee, had no real experience as a soldier. And that showed in his generalship, because he was out-generaled every time by Richard Taylor and Alfred Mouton. Technically, he might have won both the battles along the Têche, but he made several mistakes and was really outmaneuvered at every turn. And what both sides did as they were running up and down the Têche was taking from the local population, taking cattle, horses, chickens, ripping up fences, tearing down barns to use the wood for their campfires, taking wagons. And this area, after three separate invasions between 1863 and 64, was just an absolute ruin for everyone. And some people nearly starved after the conflict.
Wow. So after all this research and writing, what difference did it make for you to actually be on the bayou itself? I mean, did that make you appreciate it more? What did it add to your work?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think I could have done a very good job if I had not gone down the entire bayou myself. And I chose to do it in a canoe because I wanted to do it as deliberately as possible. And I didn't want to go quickly. I wanted to go slowly. I wanted to take a lot of photographs. I wanted to take a lot of GPS coordinates, and I wanted to take a lot of handwritten notes of what I saw.
Now, you know, you refer to the Têche as Louisiana's most famous bayou, and part of the reason is it's the most famous in contemporary life is because James Lee Burke has written so much about it and so beautifully about it. And the first time I interviewed him, he said something to me. And I'm asking you this largely just for myself. But he said, you know, they say if you drink from the Bayou Têche, you'll never leave.
Huh.
Have you ever heard that?
One of the histories of Bayou Têche, or rather New Iberia, published in the early 60s, is called They Drank Bayou Water. And when the current president of the Têche Project, which is a volunteer group that cleans up the bayou, when the current president was sworn into office at the group's annual dinner, she had to drink a snifter of Têche water, which I later found out was not actually Têche water. It was chocolate milk or something like that. But symbolically, she drank it. Well, the thing is, you know, there are a lot of Cajuns and Creoles that live along the Têche, and it's actually been shown by historians that Cajuns tend to live within 50 miles of where they were born. We just sort of like to stay in an area where there are other Cajuns.
Well, look at you, three blocks from the bayou.
Yeah, right. I mean, at one point I went off to New York City and thought I was going to stay there, or in Los Angeles. That's what I wanted to do when I was in my early 20s back in the 1980s. And I ended up coming back and studying practically my own backyard. But that, again, is common for Cajun and Creole historians and linguists and folklorists and cultural activists. We refer to something called the exile experience. Some of us even could not wait to get out of here because we claimed we didn't like it. And then when we got away from the area, we found that we actually missed it and came back and sort of made it our life's mission to study it. And that certainly happened to me. And, you know, when I got to New York, I decided, oh, I don't want to major in that. I want to be a writer, and I can do that back home. And I'd like to write about Cajuns and Creoles and South Louisiana history. And part of that, I think, is finding a subject that no one else has written about yet. And no one had written a history of Bayou Têche. So when the idea occurred to me, I just thought it was a missing volume waiting to be written.
Well, lucky for us readers, you came back to do it. We've been talking with Shane Bernard, who's the author of Tesh, A History of Louisiana's Most Famous Bayou. This book will be honored, along with Hardscrabble to Hallelujah, Volume 1, Bayou Terrebonne, Legacies of Terrebonne Parish, Louisiana. That's by Christopher Sinak with Claire Domingue Joller, as the Humanities Books of the Year by the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities at their Bright Lights Award Dinner Thursday, April 13th at the Shaw Center for the Arts in Baton Rouge. For more information, check out leh.org. Shane, congratulations on this well-deserved award, and thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
James Nolan is a real New Orleans character. In one marvelous moment in his new book, he writes, "I am a living exhibition in the Urban Museum. I've often considered asking the mayor's office for a monthly stipend to walk the streets wearing a beret and carrying a baguette under my arm." But James has done so much more than that. He's a poet, essayist, novelist, translator, and teacher. He's lived all over the world. And today we'll be talking about his new memoir, Flight Risk, Memoirs of a New Orleans Bad Boy. Well, James Nolan, New Orleans Bad Boy, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here. I haven't taken off yet.
No. Now, you really have written everything, James. So what about memoir? What is the appeal of this for you now?
Well, I think in New Orleans, we're great storytellers. And storytelling is a way to consolidate who you are. Most of the book is narrative. And I think that we always come back to telling stories about ourselves in order to create the narrative of our lives. And I think, as we find out from Alzheimer's patients, when you lose the narrative of your life, you've lost you.
Right.
So it's a way of reinforcing. I like to think of it as editing yourself into existence with the blue pencil of selected memory.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'd like to edit my life, you know.
Well, you can always forget the parts. But actually, what you do when you write memoirs, you go to what I call the wince moments, those moments that you'd almost rather forget.
There are a lot of those in this book, I suspect.
There really are. And I've changed several of the names.
Now, so much of this book is about that great story of leaving and returning to a place. And near the opening of this book, you want to leave so badly and so desperately that your family has you committed and you're struggling to get away from New Orleans.
Well, yes, my parents did commit me to St. Vincent de Paul, which I think is closed now, thank God, in 1968, because I was really active in the war resistance movement against the war in Vietnam. And I was active in the civil rights movement and actually went to jail several times. And so they thought that this definitely constituted crazy behavior. And so at that time, what was prevalent in New Orleans was what is called coroner commitment, where any doctor can call up the coroner and have you picked up and locked away by your family for as long as they want.
That sounds like a book in itself right there. It does, doesn't
yes.
it?
I'm glad I escaped, because I would have been... I got out through the efforts of the American Civil Liberties Union, and I was supposed to be the test case for coroner commitment in 1968, and that was finally won in 1976.
It's amazing.
Yes.
How long that took. There are so many lovely images of flight in this book. You know, I thought of that story of Walter Anderson, who escaped from one commitment and had painted birds going out the window of his room, you know. And one of the most wonderful images in this book is that moment when you discover you're an artist. And that is also a bird moment.
Right. I decide that I want to be like the sparrow outside of the window. Then the sparrow is sitting on eggs. So I cut out eggs from construction paper. And my aunt helps me put them in a straw box. And I sit on them. And as anyone can see, I'm a sparrow. And and I say that basically that my imagination took flight at that moment.
I know.
The imagination is the only country in which I've ever claimed full citizenship.
Well, You could be the mayor. No.
the own country of my imagination. As a matter of fact, I am.
So one of the things I love about this book is that there's such warmth when you write about your family, which is such a crazy New Orleans family.
They certainly are, but they raised me right. They really did. And that Creole world that I grew up in has pretty much disappeared. So it's with real nostalgia that I look back on it.
Oh. Well, nostalgia of almost the best sort seems to permeate this book. It's nostalgia for all the good and sweet things, pretty much.
Some of it, of course, and then
there
are other escape stories. And, you know, I have a whole section called Away at Sea, because in my family there were set phrases to describe people, like spinsters were called unclaimed jewels. And men who weren't present were away at sea. So for about 30 years, I was away at sea. And during which time I moved to San Francisco, I was part of a sort of a gender-bending theater group called the Coquettes. I became a revolutionary in Latin America. I escaped from a Guatemalan jail. Then I went to live and teach in China. I escaped from that totalitarian country. And then began to live through the 80s in San Francisco. But I did spend a good at least 10 years as an immigrant, an expatriate in Spain, which is a country I feel very comfortable in.
And you've done so much translating from Spanish, right?
I have, yes. Spain is an entire country like New Orleans, except there are no guns.
Nicely put. Yes. So how do you feel about having written this book? Has it given you a sense of peace, closure, just admiration for your own survival? What?
I think that memoir is more than about a person if it's going to be successful. Mm-hmm. So this really isn't just about my little life. A successful memoir is a history of time and place. So I've written about the times and places I've lived through, which included the very end of Creole New Orleans. As I like to say, I was raised in the long last afternoon of the 19th century in Creole New Orleans. And then it's the history of my generation and of the counterculture and of San Francisco. It's also a lot of Spanish history of the transition to democracy after Franco's death, which I lived in Pedro Almodóvar's punky streets of Barcelona and Madrid.
You do seem to have been always in the right place at the right time.
I guess my life has been a little bit like Forrest Gump's.
Right. That's what you think when you read this book.
Well, you see, that's kind of intentional on my part, because basically it is the history of time and place. It is about me, but it's about how I was interacting with where I was at the moment. But I think more significant for most readers will be, what was it like to grow up in the 50s in New Orleans? What was it like to go as a flower child to San Francisco? What was it like to escape from a Guatemalan jail during the dictatorships of the 1970s and 80s? And what was it like to live the transition to democracy in Spain and to come home again?
Well, I have to say, been there, done that, wrote the memoir.
Yes, well, this is actually the first volume.
I had a feeling.
I'm still living, yes. I'm still very much alive, and I have chapters piling up of a new book. Yeah.
We've been talking with James Nolan, whose new book is Flight Risk, Memoirs of a New Orleans Bad Boy. And he was bad. You can meet him Thursday, April 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. James, thanks so much.
Thanks very much, Susan. I enjoyed it.
Kathleen Schrenk is making her writing debut with a fine middle grade novel, A Dog Steals Home. She's been a speech therapist and a teacher, and now she spends her time volunteering for great causes like NOLA City Bark and the Louisiana SPCA. No wonder dogs are such great characters in this novel. So Kathy Schrenk, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan.
Now, A Dog Steals Home is such a charmer. It's just the sweetest, most fun little book. Now, how did you choose writing for a middle grade audience?
I actually started to write the book as a picture book, and then it grew. And because I taught sixth graders, it just seemed more natural for me to write for a middle grade audience.
Now, it's pretty obvious that you love dogs.
Yes.
From your resume and your book. And what also shines through in this book is that you know a lot about baseball.
I do.
Which was very entertaining, because Zach Stewart, your main character, is an aspiring pitcher.
Yes. That goes back to many innings sitting in the bleachers. I have three sons who are all grown up, but we sat through many innings of baseball, and I loved it. It was fun.
Well, you set that up very nicely. So tell us a little bit about Zach and what he's facing and, you know, what propels his story in this book.
Okay, well, Zach, I think, is a fairly typical 11-year-old, 12-year-old, sixth grader, and he's sort of awkward, and his parents are about to have his first sibling, who he refers to as the little lizard, and he's not really happy about that. He doesn't, you know, he's not into it. First of all, he finds it very awkward that they're having a baby at this late stage in their life. And they have a dog, a very old dog, who was the family dog even before Zach was born. And he loves the dog, Dingo. But the dog really can't be a companion to him the way he sees his friend's dogs being a companion. So he wants a puppy, too. And then he's also facing competition at being the first pitcher on his team for the first time. And the other guy seems to be a lot better. So those are the things he's struggling with.
And he also has a friend who's in a bit of trouble, and he's trying to help her out, too.
Yes. Audrey, who he doesn't really think of her as a friend in the beginning of the book. He thinks of her sort of as somebody that he wishes would go away.
Yes.
Because she's a new kid in school, and he's the only person that she's trying to befriend, and he thinks of it sort of as an annoyance.
Now, one of the things I love about this book is that you talk about a lot of good causes, and you put kids right in the middle of them in the best kind of way. Zach does a research project at the SPCA, and his friend Audrey talks about reading to Rover, which is very dear to my heart, too.
It is. It's a good program. Both of those are good nonprofits. And yes, the teacher assigns a class project at the end of the year. Everybody needs to, in the class, has to pick a volunteer organization, a nonprofit, to research and figure out how that organization helps the community. And I've been involved with volunteering most of my life, but more so since I retired from teaching. And I know how important it is. And I think it's important for children to participate.
And you do that in the nicest possible way. I really like the way you set Zach on the path.
Thank you.
You know, it's very nice. Now, you're a member of the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. And I wonder if you'd tell us how that group has helped you along the way.
It's helped a lot. An editor, a freelance editor that had taken a look at my very first manuscript, which was a picture book, said, you need to join SCBWI and learn something. And so I did. And not only has it helped with learning how to critique and how to be critiqued, we meet editors, we meet other writers, we have conferences. There's a magazine that I get that gives me ideas or helpful points, even into the business aspect of it, you know. So there's the craft aspect of writing and then the business aspect of writing. And SCBWI has helped with that immensely.
Well, you seem to have had a lot of fun writing this book. It must have been fun from your point of view.
I did, because it was based on a dog, Dingo, that we had. Our first grandchild noticed this old dog. I started to think about the relationship between a child who grows up with a dog that's already in the home, and it wasn't his dog necessarily, it was his parents' dog, and how that relationship worked out over time.
And you said you're already at work on your next book?
I am. I've actually finished the first of the 10 drafts or whatever, the 10th of the first 10. I mean, yes, it's sort of ready to go.
Well, that's exciting.
Thank you. You
want to stick with this audience? You're not going back to picture books?
No, this is middle grade, but it is not set in New Orleans as this book is. It's set in North Carolina.
Aha.
So, and it's a mystery, too. This one is a mystery, the new one.
Going back to your Nancy Drew days, huh?
Yeah, sort of Nancy Drew meets Sue Grafton type
All
of thing.
All right. Well, that would entertain anybody. Oh, well, this is a delight, this book. And you are a delight, too. We've been talking with Kathleen Schrenk, whose new book for middle grade readers is called A Dog Steals Home. Kathy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Kathleen Schrenk, signs A Dog Steals Home, Tuesday, April 4th from 9 to 1 at the Crescent City Farmers Market in Uptown Square. That's at an LASPCA offsite adoption event. Claudia Gray debuts her new young adult novel, Defy the Stars, Tuesday, April 4th at 5 at Octavia Books. C.S. Harris signs Where the Dead Lie, Tuesday, April 4th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Tulane University and the Dayton Literary Prize present a discussion, Bridge to Understanding, a discussion on systemic racism in America, moderated by Bernice McFadden and featuring former recipients of the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, Margaret Wrinkle, author of Wash, Wilbert Rideau, author of In the Place of Justice, A Story of Punishment and Deliverance, and Gilbert King, author of The Devil in the Grove, Thurgood Marshall, The Groveland Boys, and The Dawn of a New America. That's Tuesday, April 4th from 6 to 8 at the Woldenberg Arts Center on the Tulane campus. Susan Cushman, editor, and contributors Emma Connolly, Nancy K. Westman, and Susan Marquez discuss and sign A Second Blooming, Becoming the Women We Are Meant to Be, Wednesday, April 5th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Tiffany Rice and Jen LeBlanc sign the Nightmark and the Lords of Time series, Wednesday, April 5th at 6 at Octavia Books. Room 220 hosts the New Orleans launch party for Jamie Attenberg's novel, All Grown Up, Thursday, April 6th at 7 at the Saturn Bar. Zachary Lazar interviews the author after her reading. Today's guest, James Nolan, reads from and signs Flight Risk, Memoirs of a New Orleans Bad Boy, Thursday, April 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Elizabeth Cobb signs The Hello Girls, America's First Women Soldiers, Thursday, April 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. Stuart Gibbs signs his latest children's book in the Fun Jungle series, Pandemonium, Friday, April 7th at 4:30 at Octavia Books. The New Orleans Museum of Art is issuing a call for poets in grades 8 through 12 for their free poetry workshop. That's led by Broad Baggert at the museum Saturday, April 8th from 10 to 4. Participants will tour the museum, select a work of art that inspires them, then write a poem that they can submit to NOMA for publication in a book. For more information, contact Sheila Cork, librarian at NOMA, at 504-658-4117 or scork@noma.org. An edible book day is coming up at the New Orleans Museum of Art Friday, April 7th. Demonstrate your love of books, baking, and art. Local community groups and individuals are invited to bake and decorate cakes inspired by books. Here's the schedule. Cake setup takes place at 4:30. Judging and People's Choice ballots start at 5:30. There'll be a cake decorating demo at 6:30 in the NOMA Cafe. Then the awards are announced at 7. Start baking your book cakes, people. Crescent City Books hosts a meet and greet with Seamus Award winner David Fulmer. He'll be signing his Storyville Mysteries, which are being reprinted by Crescent City Books. That's Saturday, April 8th at 9:30 a.m. James Russell signs The Dragon Hunters, Monday, April 10th at 4:15 at Octavia Books. And coming up soon, the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities celebrates its annual Bright Lights Award dinner, honoring Humanist of the Year William Joyce and many others, including today's guest, Shane Bernard. That's Thursday, April 13th at 7 at the Shaw Center for the Arts in Baton Rouge. Check out leh.org for tickets. And get ready for the second annual New Orleans Poetry Festival, April 20th through 23rd at the New Orleans Healing Center and other venues. The complete schedule is up at nolapoetry.com. Poetry for everyone. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.